turning on a faucet, and we give little thought to what makes that possible. So you go hiking, and you need to filter your water to protect against toxins. The process of running water through a filter isn't hard, but it is tedious and inconvenient. A few years ago, I spent a few days hiking a portion of the Finger Lakes Trail, and when we got to our site the first night, we went to go filter our water, found that the filter wasn't working properly. We couldn't get it to suck the water through, and so we were left with no other option than to boil our water. And when you have to boil water, and that's the only option you have, then you don't take fresh water for granted. Nor did our ancestors. In the early 1800s, before there was modern plumbing and sewage, the city of New York faced a severe lack of fresh water to meet the need of their rapidly growing population. Aside from a few scattered wells, the city had one major source of water, a pond that was called the Collect in Lower Manhattan. It served as a reservoir and, increasingly, as a sewage tank. People dumped all sorts of things into the Collect. Garbage, chamber pots, even dead cattle. Not an ideal source of fresh water. In 1978, a yellow fever epidemic caused 2,000 fatalities and breakouts in 1805, 1819, 1822 cost thousands of more lives. And in 1832, it was cholera spread by contaminated water that cost 3,000 lives. 2 years later, a fire started near Wall Street in the dead of winter, and the rivers were frozen over. The firefighters had no way to quench the fire. It raged for 24 hours, and 700 buildings were destroyed. More than a quarter of the city, New York City, reduced to rubble. All of these major disasters and a whole bunch of minor ones led to this public pressure to find a solution, which in some respects is really quite simple. Because what is lacking downstate in the city is really quite abundant upstate in the Catskills. They just had to get the fresh water from the Catskills to the city from one place to another, and that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. Because to do so would require a complex network of reservoirs, aqueducts, tunnels to store and transport the water. So it began work on the most extensive municipal water system in the world. This system began with two giant reservoirs in the Catskills from which the water is drawn through the Catskills by aqueduct to supply the Hillview Reservoir in Yonkers, just north of the city. From there, the water is pumped into the city by two giant water tunnels, creatively labeled Tunnel Number 1 and Tunnel Number 2. And even today, work continues as they are building a third water tunnel, started in 1969, slated to be completed in 2020. Any guesses on the name of the third water tunnel? Yeah, Water Tunnel Number 3. As a construction fee, it depends on a group of workers called Sandhogs. These are the men who blast the tunnels 200 to 800 feet below the ground to supply clean, fresh water to the city. It's tedious, labor-intensive work. The passer's all done by blasting. You drill a hole, stick the dynamite in the picture hole in a wall that would start really small but get bigger, like a hole in an airplane cabin, anything not secured, gets sucked out. Done with a 450-ton, 19-foot-wide tunnel boring machine called the Mole. It's so massive that it has to be lowered in piece by piece and then assembled on site. And even with all the advances in equipment and safety, there is still danger in this work. They have a saying, a mile a meter. They lose approximately mile of tunnel that is completed. The fact is that they are right on pace for that. This third tunnel is being dug right now. But this is what it takes to supply the world's largest city with the fresh water that it needs. When you turn on a faucet in New York City, water pours out because thousands of sandhogs have spent countless hours boring tunnels through rock and dirt to transmit water from the Catskills into the city. They've devoted their efforts, their energies, and in some cases, their lives to this pursuit. David Grant, author of a great essay about sandhogs in a book entitled The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, writes, "As an engineering feat, the water tunnel system rivals the Brooklyn Bridge or the Panama Canal. It has the odd distinction that almost no one will see it. Almost no one sees it because it's underground. It's not there to be on display. Almost no one will see it, but millions use it. 1.3 billion gallons of water flow through those pipes. This isn't really a story about the New York City water system. It's an elaborate illustration, a parable that's meant to illustrate God's grace. This is tragic as the lack of fresh water in New York City in the 1800s. Far more devastating is the lack of God's grace in the world today. Sin is more widespread and more devastating than the worst outbreak of yellow fever in the population of New York City. God's reservoir of grace is abundant, fresh, pure, unlimited. It is far removed from the world that so desperately needs it. The world that, for the most part, is surviving on the collect. This reservoir includes selfishness and greed and pride and anger and deceit and slander and lust. And sadly, you had to drink from that pool. Gulping on the consequences of someone else's sin, you had to deal with that. You get stuck with a mouthful of their sewage. But the flip side is, don't fool yourselves. You've added your own part. Made your own contribution cannot dig the tunnels to get the water there. So, when speaking of God's grace, what are the tunnels? Who are the sand dogs? How does God give his grace to the world? Well, the obvious answer is Jesus. It's a good church answer. It's right. As far as it goes, Jesus is the preeminent sand dog. So in John chapter 1, verse 14, it says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. John speaking about Jesus, the Word becoming flesh. We have seen the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Hone in on that grace piece of it. So he is full of grace. Like a reservoir spilling over, this grace is in abundance. Now we drop down to verse 16. From the fullness of his grace, from that reservoir that is cresting over, we have all received one blessing after another. In other words, his grace is spilling over into our blessing. So yes, Jesus is absolutely a conduit of grace into this world. But there's only one answer. And that answer is really tidy and a bit distant. There's another answer that may not be as obvious, but is crucial for us to grasp. This is where I need you to be active listeners. Because these are like cookies that are way up on the top shelf. You're going to have to stretch to get the goodies. So just track with me. Trust that it'll be worth the effort. We've been in this series of 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 7 through 10. We've reached verse 10. So here's the text that we're working with today. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. Now, there is a word play in this verse that is lost in translation. It's kind of like when you translate a poem from one language into another and it doesn't rhyme anymore. It's obvious in the original, it's obscured by the translation. Well, in English, it's easy for us to overlook this, even if we're reading it really carefully. But in Greek, since it was written in, it would have been obvious, even to a child reading this. It's not something hidden, it's right there if we're reading it in the original. In this case, it's not rhyming like a poem, but it's two words that share the same root. And anybody reading this in Greek, you're seeing this. So I'm going to point it out to you. The root is the word charis, and that's the word grace translated in the text. Grace. God's undeserved favor. And this verse is used in the context of faithfully administering God's charis, his undeserved favor. The other word, the derivative of this, is the word gift earlier in the verse. And that word in Greek is charismata. You can see the parallel, those shared root, charis, and charismata. That means gift. Gift is a tangible expression of God's grace. Something received is not deserved. So each one of us should use whatever charismata we have received. So Peter brings both of those words together. He is saying that we are to use our spiritual gift, our charismata, to administer, or to steward, or distribute God's grace, his charis. We use our charismata to channel God's charis. There's a semantic connection in the words between your spiritual gift and God's grace. And it's not just that our gifts are an expression of grace, though they are that. Here the emphasis is that they are a channel of God's grace, like a pipeline, like a conduit. Not simply that it's evidence of God's grace in me, it is a pathway for God to get his grace to flow through me into the world. I don't know if you district flows through me. I don't know, but you know, that blows my mind. But the primary way that God will transmit His grace into the world is through my utilizing my spiritual gift. That means that when a handful of us yesterday gathered in the parking lot of Adirondack Reader, or Adirondack Kids Day, and we made popcorn and cotton candy and hot chocolate, and we offered a small treat and a smile to kids and adults who were there, we were doing more than just serving junk food. We were serving junk food. But as we did that, we were administering God's grace. Cotton candy, that's like just it's spun sugar on a paper tube. Or they deft it into a blob. Well, sometimes it was masterfully deft into a nice shape. But how can that be an expression of God's grace to the world? And yet, that's what we find. You know, that doesn't sound real spiritual. I don't claim to understand it all. I'm just telling you what the Word of God says, that when you use your gift faithfully, whatever that gift may be, whatever you may do to find a way to express your gift, high profile, low profile, no profile at all, it doesn't matter. In every case, you are acting as a sandbox, as a way for God to take His grace and funnel it into the world. We're a small church, but we have an opportunity to be channels of God's blessing to Inlet and Old Forge and those just passing through as guests. So these are two, three brief implications for you to think about relationships. The first is this, that everyone is invited. Each of you, that's all inclusive. Every person here, each of you, every person sitting here is included, should use whatever gift. That's all inclusive. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you are invited to join God's team of sandbox, to be a pipeline of God's grace into the world. So, we're this small church. Several years we may burst at the seams, but now, and even more so in 2 weeks after Columbus Day, there's not a lot of people left. Our small band of locals will carry the torch. The reality is, and something that, that John has said before, that we are a church that God has blessed financially, and we are cash rich. Don't have a lot of human resources available year-round. Which means that it is that much more critical for us as a church to use what capital we have of people to the best of our ability. That we take that poverty of people and we stretch that resource as far as it can go. That we not use it carelessly, that we invest it carefully. If you've got a church of hundreds and hundreds of people, and those who serve, they can cover for those who don't. There's more wiggle room in that kind of budget. But when you've got a church of 30, 40 people, there's not a lot of wiggle room. That we need every one of those people to be using their gift in ministry. We can't afford to have passive attenders. Everybody on board. So, when you come here, I hope that you are a recipient of God's grace, that somehow through our ministry, we are a channel of God's grace into your life. I hope that's the case. But don't just be a grace receptor, receiving grace. Be a grace conveyor. Find a way that you can be a channel of grace in the world. Everybody's a second implication is there is no small job, no ministry can be described not just. It is bigger than that. Listen to the next verse. If anyone speaks, he should do it. If anyone speaks in the very words of God, if anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides. Speaking is not just speaking. It's being the mouthpiece of God. And serving is not just serving. It is divinely empowered serving. So we tend to minimize the magnitude of the effect of our ministry. We have no idea how God can use what we consider to be small things. I suppose that the Zanarchs, as they're inching their way through bedrock, can feel like that job is pretty small. Like they're not making much progress. I mean, it has taken them, what now, 40-some odd years in building this third tunnel. And yet, they're not just digging a tunnel. They're providing fresh water for one of the greatest cities in the world. So in your ministry, no matter how small it seems, don't lose sight of the fact that that is a way for you to convey God's grace into the world. Third, there is really just one factor that determines the rate of flow, how much grace gets through our pipeline. It's like water pressure in a pipe. This is what determines how much grace flows through that pipe valve. Because if it's what God is doing in the world, and if He is channeling His grace into the world through our use of our gifts, then I would much rather be a fire hose than a leaky faucet. It's hard to believe that He would use me to convey grace, but if that's what He's going to do, then I want as much to flow through me as possible. So how do we increase the rate of flow? Like how can you get as much grace flowing through you? It has nothing to do with what ministry you're involved in. It could be any ministry. It doesn't really matter. And that will not impede the flow of God's grace. It's not as if, because I'm the pastor, I get a fire hose, and because you sit in the pew, you get a coffee stirrer and a little dribble that comes out. The rate of flow is not determined by the ministry that you serve in. Instead, it's determined by how you serve. It's not what you do, but how you do it. The key word is faithfully. Faithfully in ministering God's grace. Is that what characterizes your ministry? Is ministry a priority for you? I don't have time for that. I'm busy. I've got poor kids, busy schedules. I take it here and there for soccer game, for cross-country meet, for parent meeting, this, that, and the other thing. Of course, we all have that. But is ministry, service in the church, priority for you? Be faithful. Give it your best energy. Be constant, firm, loyal, steadfast, resolute, reliable. Are you living up to Paul's admonition? 1 Corinthians 15:58. Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. Do you know that your labor is not in vain? It's not in vain. It's not in vain because you are laying a pipeline for God's grace to flow through you. So how does a New York City Sandhawk feel about what they're doing? Three responses from a real Sandhawk. It's exciting, the risk, the challenge, and then to know that you're doing something not only for yourself, but for the whole of New York City. I just feel like every day I come out here and I'm doing something, I'm accomplishing something.